supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom.
This is a song that represents the civil rights movement of the 1960s for many people. Although it's not exactly the kind of woke we're exploring today, it's closely related to a never-ending struggle for equality. We are thinking of woke as in being aware, attuned, vigilant to your surroundings. I'm Jamie Jay, and this is Common Space. For this episode, we asked three storytellers to weave their stories around the theme of woke. And they came up with three completely different takes.
Jamie, before we start...
Oh, that's WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna.
What is your take on woke?
Oh, for me, it's that moment when you realize it, that everything is not the same for everybody. Things are different for different people. It's like something happens and an alarm goes off, a confusing, frustrating, heartbreaking alarm that says, pay attention to this. It's really important.
Wake up! Wake up! Wake up! Wake up!
Wake up!
Wake up!
Come on, come on, wake up!
Wake up!
And once you hear that alarm bell, that bell can't be unrung. And maybe it shouldn't. Let's call these woke moments.
That makes sense to me.
But, you know, I didn't come up with that term. Woke and stay woke is a term that has become very popular. It was resurrected after the Mike Brown shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, by the Black Lives Matter movement. And it meant stay aware, especially stay aware of social injustice and racism. And so today, when we talk about these woke moments from these woke storytellers, we see how the conversation began with the Black Lives Matter movement, and it has now branched out to elevate the consciousness of everybody. So these three storytellers today, you know, may not be directly connected with the Black Lives Matter movement, but had clear, authentic, stay woke moments. So it's beautiful how it's just pushed out to all of us and elevating our consciousness for everybody.
Woke moments indeed. Well, our first storyteller is Megan Hicks. Listen up.
Alberta and I moved in next door to each other in the spring of 1986. It was an ethnically diverse neighborhood in Oklahoma City, a magnet for refugees, mostly Vietnamese, Cambodians, Guatemalans. Alberta was a refugee from a blighted neighborhood in Cleveland. She loved her new home. She had a job, a car, affordable rent in a safe neighborhood, and a cousin close by who could help her with her two-year-old. I was a refugee from the suburbs, a couple of zip codes away, and a failed marriage. I hated this place. I was underemployed, trying to make ends meet with two small children, a volatile ex-husband, and a boyfriend who was bearing disturbing similarities to all the men I had ever been involved with. This was the only neighborhood I could afford, and I didn't see any way out. I enjoyed getting to know Alberta. Our visits across the driveway, another single mother to commiserate with. Three or four times a week, coming in from work, we just stand outside and talk. I thought, we are peas in a pod. We get each other. We're in the same boat. But then she started dating this guy, Donald. He seemed nice enough. We never really spoke, but he'd wave if we were both outside at the same time. Good-looking man, always well-dressed. Two or three nights a week, his car would be parked out in front of Alberta's house. It looked like things were going great. But now I hardly ever saw Alberta anymore. You know, sometimes I wouldn't see her for several days, and then she would appear, rushing from her front door to the car. "Hi, Alberta!" And all I'd get was a wave over the back of her shoulder. Probably late for work, just like me. Sometimes after a long absence, I'd see her dragging herself from her car to the front door. "Hey, Alberta, how you doing?" She'd adjust her sunglasses and look the other way, like she was avoiding me. I understood completely. She probably just needed some space. I mean, she worked in a beauty shop from 7 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. You know, maybe she just didn't feel like talking. One time I startled her, though. Walking home from the store, I cut across her lawn just as she opened the door to check the mail. Her eyes, they were bloodshot, swollen almost shut, like she'd been crying really hard. Well, I could relate to crying hard. I mean, we were both in a chronic state of exhaustion. Single parenting is the equivalent of 3 8-hour shifts every day, on top of work and a relationship. I got it. We were in the same boat. At this time, I had about half a dozen part-time jobs. I was also sleeping with one of my bosses, Curtis, the one who was there waiting for me when I ran away from the suburbs and my marriage. The man with whom things would be different this time. For over a year, we had been talking about leaving Oklahoma City and finding a better life. Richer, fuller, culturally stimulating, politically enlightened, somewhere else. We would get out. Someday, we would. But here it was a year later. July 4th weekend, my kids spent the holiday with their father. I spent it in a protracted and bewildering fight with Curtis. I didn't even know what we were fighting about. I thought, what have I done to make him so angry? And the louder he got, the more I shut down. Silent. Withdrawn. I went in my mind to the top branches of a tree where I looked down at Curtis, screaming, "Answer me right now!" But I was scared. I couldn't talk. I couldn't move. And then Curtis stormed out of the house, slammed the door, roared away in his car, and suddenly I was out of that tree and back in my cramped little house. Now I was screaming. I was smashing dishes on the floor. I was having an epiphany. Nothing's changed. Nothing's gonna change. Nothing's different than the way it's always been, and that's the way it's always gonna be. I yelled until I was hoarse, till my throat was raw. Cried till my eyes were swollen and bloodshot. And then I collapsed on my daughter's bed near the only window in the house that caught a breeze. I was awakened by what sounded like every dog within a 3-block radius going nuts. I looked out all my windows, listened for footsteps, for the scrabbling sounds that possums and raccoons make. No intruders, just that barking, yelping, baying, yipping, whining, snarling, growling, and then as if on cue. Silence. The alarm clock read 3:05 a.m.
We have to take a mini break here. It almost feels like a cliffhanger. And I tell you, the live audience at the Fringe Arts Theater in Philadelphia was almost holding its breath. I had the feeling that if they could, some members of the audience would shout to Megan, "Be woke, girl. Don't you understand what's happening?" Okay, if you're just joining us, thank you for tuning in. Today, we're hearing stories of people who were awakened to the harsh realities around them. We're calling them woke moments. Megan Hicks is about to have her woke moment regarding her friend and neighbor, Alberta, who lives next door. You see, Megan thought she and Alberta were in the same boat because they lived in the same place and were single moms.
I went back to bed and woke up shortly after sunrise. The heat would be bearable for another few hours, and I wanted to get to the lumberyard when they first opened to buy decking for the treehouse that Curtis had started in the backyard. I'd lay the floor today. That was my plan to get back into his good graces. I would buy 2x8 10-foot planks and a big box of 16-penny galvanized nails, have the floor all laid and done, ready to show him the next time he came over, if he ever came over again. Well, I checked the money in my wallet, found my keys, out the door, and
175 Second Avenue 10-4.
What were four police cruisers doing parked in the street in front of my house, blocking my driveway? I hadn't heard any sirens. What would bring four silent squad cars to my front yard? And then a fifth vehicle pulled up behind them, and across the back of it, I read, "Coroner." A cop in my driveway told me to stay inside my house. What's going on? Get back inside. What happened? Get inside your house. Well, for God's sake, who's dead? Lady, get inside. So I stepped inside and stood there, my open door, watching it come and go. A couple of women from down the street wandered into my yard, and one of the cops went over to talk to them. He took notes. As soon as he turned away, I shot outside, and I said, "Can you please tell me what the hell is going on?" They just looked at me, up and down, without a word. I said, "Is Alberta all right?" "She's over there in that squad car. She's fine." And there she was, sitting in the back seat. "What about the baby? How's he?" "He's with her cousin. He's fine too." "Well then, who's dead?" One of the women said, "My brother. She got him with a kitchen knife while he was sleeping. About 3 o'clock this morning. A couple hours ago, she called the cops, her own self." And then without another word, they turned and walked away. An ambulance glided up. No lights, no sirens. Two men in uniforms, white uniforms, pushed a gurney across the yard into Alberta's house. 15 minutes later, they came out again, with a tidy white bundle strapped to that gurney. They slid it into the back of the ambulance, latched the doors, silently glided away, and then the cops drove off. The street hovered in stillness for about a minute. The stillness was shattered by the low rumble of a motorcycle, one of the neighborhood kids coming in from an all-nighter. It was as if his arrival had broken the surface tension, and by ones and by twos, all up and down the street, people left their houses and gathered in my driveway. Here's what I pieced together from what I heard. Those times when Alberta would dodge past, when I tried to greet her, she was avoiding me. She would look my way or stop to visit, only on the days when her face wasn't messed up. She had asked him, told him, demanded that he get out of her life. And he kept coming back. Kept coming back because he couldn't live without her. Kept coming back and beating her up. She made him go away the only way she knew how. We all stood there for a few minutes, looking down at the ground, looking up at the sky, looking just about anywhere but directly at one another. And then we were finished feeling shocked. No new information was forthcoming. I'd find out more about it in tomorrow's paper. It was late morning. I still had time to get to the lumberyard. I brought my planks home and my box of 16-penny galvanized nails. And one board at a time, I carried them from the bed of my little pickup to the backyard. And one board at a time, I nailed them into place. I swung that hammer with my whole arm, and I watched those nail heads shudder between blows. I sank them straight, pounding, pounding, pounding that floor into place, drenched with sweat and dizzy from the heat. Pound, 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 fist in face. Pound, pound, pound. You come down. Pound, pound, pound. Answer me. Pound, pound, pound. Knife in heart. Curtis dropped by that afternoon. Our fight was over. He didn't mention it. Neither did I. His response to the work that I had done on the treehouse was a raised eyebrow and a silent nod. I had hoped he'd be happy about the initiative I took on his project, but he didn't have any criticism to offer. And with Curtis, sometimes that was the highest praise. Next morning, I went out and got a paper, Sunday paper. I mean, big news had happened right next door, and I wanted to read all about it. So I leafed through cover to cover. No mention of a homicide on Northwest 29th Street. Maybe the story hadn't been filed in time. It would be in tomorrow's paper. So I bought a Monday paper. Nothing. Tuesday, nothing. Wednesday, Thursday. Finally, on Friday, I called a friend who was a reporter. I said, hey, what's up with this? My neighbor just killed somebody. And I didn't hear anything. I didn't read anything about it. Oh, yeah, he said. That stabbing last Sunday, yes. I saw it come over the wire. I said, well, how did I miss the story? He said, there was no story. Why? Well, it was domestic violence, and they were both black, right? Yeah. Well, at the paper, we have a little shorthand for that kind of stuff. You know, black-on-black violence, especially domestic violence. At the paper, we call it a TND. A TND? Yeah. A typical nigger deal. Sweetie, it happens all the time. It's not news. The following morning, Alberta was back at her house, packing everything she could into her car. She told me that the judge said since she had taken out a restraining order on him, and since Donald had put her in the hospital, he could call this something like voluntary manslaughter, make it all go away for her. All she had to do was go back to Cleveland and never set foot over the Oklahoma state line again. That night, I woke up at 3:05 a.m. Curtis was sleeping over. I lay there awake for a few minutes, making up my mind. Then I crawled over him and I turned over my desk lamp. What's wrong? What's wrong? He mumbled. Nothing. Just got to do something. Go back to sleep. I reached to the bottom of my waste paper basket, looking for something I had thrown away the day it came in the mail. There it was, underneath the catalogs and all the torn envelopes. To request an application, write or call toll-free, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 1-800. What the hell are you doing? It's after 3 o'clock. I was locating that toll-free number I would call first thing Monday morning. That number in Princeton, New Jersey, where you apply for the graduate record exam. And another number, a local number, the University of Oklahoma School of Library and Information Science. I put my papers under my dictionary where they wouldn't blow away, and where Curtis wasn't likely to find them and start telling me why a woman with 2 kids and 6 part-time jobs didn't have time or money for graduate school. Then I lay back down, unable to sleep. And I realized I had been a sentimental fool to think that I had understood Alberta at all. That we got each other, that as single mothers we were in the same boat. Hell, we weren't even navigating the same ocean. On that July 4th, a judge busted Alberta back to square one, back to a blighted neighborhood in Cleveland that she had hoped to escape. In contrast, that was the day I began to realize that I had options. Graduate school would prove to be my ticket out of these circumstances. And with or without that man sleeping next to me, I would leave on my terms. My enrollment in graduate school was the beginning of the end of my relationship with Curtis. He dumped me for another woman in desperate circumstances. Thank heaven. At the time, I did not have the clarity or the strength to dump him. 4 years from this July 4th, as a newly minted librarian, I've moved my little household to Virginia, where my kids finished growing up and went to high school. I hope Alberta was able to discover and explore her path. I hope she is loved. I hope that little boy of hers got to grow up.
Megan Hicks went on from getting that master's degree to being a public librarian for over a dozen years. She now hosts the Rose Valley Storytelling House concerts. She also teaches origami and storytelling through origami. Elizabeth and I asked Megan Hicks if she knew whatever happened to Alberta and her son. And she didn't. So I guess the two really weren't in the same boat. You're listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm your host, Jamie J, with my good friend, Elizabeth Perez Luna of WHYY. The phrase, stay woke, was resurrected by the Black Lives Matter movement after the protests in Ferguson, Missouri, following the shooting of Mike Brown. And using the term woke in this context has become so common that it was recently added to the Oxford English Dictionary, defined as being well-informed, up-to-date, and alert to racial or social discrimination and injustice. Our associate producer, Jen Cleary, spent some time in the streets of Philadelphia asking people what the expression stay woke meant to them.
When that phrase comes up, it's usually about police brutality towards the African-American community.
When I think of woke, I think about being politically aware and active, so not just sticking your head in the sand about what's going on, but actually doing something about it.
in recent usage, it's used a lot on social media to talk about people that are engaged in political activism, especially people who have empathy towards other groups and try to understand their point of view or socioeconomic situation. And it's also used to urge other people to get woke.
To me, staying woke means being conscious and aware of yourself, of other people, of your privileges, and just of what's going on in the world. I think that oftentimes we get too caught up in social media, what's going on TV, what's happening with celebrities and all that stuff. And it's really distracting us from putting priorities first. And by priorities, I mean what's going on in the world around you and with the people that you love.
Let's get back to our storytellers. Kitty Haley is a private investigator and a national authority on ethics in her field. Now, this is important because her job takes her to all sorts of places. Today, Kitty shares a story of her crossing the threshold into a sad and frightening world to interview a young witness.
It was 14 degrees out. Snow hadn't been plowed, but I was in a neighborhood that wouldn't have seen a snowplow anyway. Garbage bags mounded with snow turned trash into meringue. This was a vastly different neighborhood than the one I live in gentrified Philadelphia. I carefully ascended the steps of the row home and knocked. There was no doorbell. It was a piece of broken plastic. The door was opened by a young man, about 11 years old. We'll call him William. He was expecting me. His mother had given me permission to interview him in her presence, and his testimony would be used in a very important trial. I entered the dark, stale-smelling living room. It was claustrophobic, nothing but dark shadows. There were no lights, and the windows were covered. A feeling of dread descended on me. I do this for a living. I do interviews all the time. But I will never get used to the way some people are forced to live. A voice, faint and hoarse, beckoned me to come upstairs. I was uncomfortable going upstairs in a strange house, but all I could see of William in the darkness were those fawn-colored pupils and the whites of his big, beautiful eyes. I needed to escape, and so I followed him upstairs. There was a path to the left of the stairway going up, but to the right was a cascade of toys and boxes and clothing and shoes and crumpled bags with trash. It was like a waterfall of junk assaulting my passageway. So I stayed to the left and I put my hand in my pocket, clutching my pepper mace. On my right hand, I grabbed the railing and I carefully ascended. Thank goodness I did not see the dead mouse on the step until I had stepped over it. I got to the second landing and it was no better than the first. It was covered in trash. Food encrusted plates sat outside the front bedroom door on the floor. Yet light streamed in from windows in that room and made it seem somehow weirdly inviting. So we entered. It smelled like a nursing home when I walked in, and in essence, it was. The combination of antiseptic mixed with urine. In front of me, against those open windows, was a large unmade bed that had been pushed against the window wall. To my left, Maury Povich was on the television set chastising a woman who had had a baby after sex with four different men. And to my right was a hospital bed, and there was Ma. She was attached by ports and cables that came from a metal pole into her thin, mottled skin. She was inert and obviously in pain. This was going to be very, very difficult for both the child and for me. She graciously motioned to the bed for me to sit down,
and I frantically looked around for a hard surface because in my brain was going, bed bug alert. And so I walked over to the bed, pulled my coat around me, and lowered myself precariously with the very edge of my butt on the very edge of the bed, giving myself a really good quad workout. As William popped up on the bed next to me so that we could begin. So I looked at Mom and I said, please, could you lower the TV set? And thankfully she did. William was bright and observant. He was not afraid to talk about the crime that he had witnessed, which I cannot tell you about. He asked questions. He listened eagerly, staring at me with those big, bright eyes, wanting to know everything I could tell him. I explained the process to him. He was fascinated by it. He was delighted by everything and wanted to know the meaning of words. As much as he was fascinated by the process, I was fascinated by him. This was a child who would have a bright future if he was given the opportunity.
You're listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm your host, Jamie J, with WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna. Kitty Haley is in the process of interviewing William about a crime he witnessed. His name has been changed for this story. The interview is taking place inside William's home in the presence of his bedridden mother. At one moment, William's mom starts to moan in pain, and her discomfort becomes louder and more anguished.
I really was sincerely concerned for the woman. She was in distress. I asked William if there was anybody in the house who could do something because I was helpless. He hopped off the bed and ran to the back of the house, returning a few moments later with a pajama-clad woman, about 20 years of age, who stomped in from the back of the house as if she had been disturbed from something vitally important, carrying a baby, a little girl, no more than 5 months old, and she was muttering. Maybe to herself, maybe to someone, I don't know, but it was something about not having it given the afternoon meds and, well, she seemed more angry than concerned. She walked over to me and took this infant and plopped it on my lap and said, here, you take care of her while I take care of Mom. The startled child just stared at me for a second, and I stared back into eyes that were the exact same as her uncle's, but in miniature. Now, I'm a mom and a grandmom, and it was easy. I just started to sway slightly, and I readjusted the notepad on my knees. And William and I started again, and we continued where we had left off until a sound made us turn at the same time, and there was Mom on a bedpan. I was sickened. I was so ill from it, not because I had not seen worse, because, believe me, I have, but because the child was being subjected to the indignity and the pain of his parent. And so I apologized to him for putting him through this. And he said, no, this is okay. This is fun. Can we continue? I'm having a good time. And I realized how sad that was. How sad it was that recounting a crime in a room full of sickness and death was fun for this child. So we continued. We talked for maybe another 20 minutes. The little baby had fallen asleep with her head under my chin, and I rocked slowly, and we talked just to each other. And he recounted his recollections of the crime as I memorialized it. And eventually, Mom's moans subsided, and she was again able to focus upon our project. The pajama-clad woman was done, and so was I. She came over and snatched the baby out of my hands without so much as a thank you. I watched as she took the sleeping child out into the hallway towards her back part of the house, and then she let out a scream, and with the baby dangling from one arm, she grabbed a broom and started mercilessly beating yet another mouse to death in the hallway. And she turned to her brother and said, You get that thing out of here. You hear me? He walked in the hallway and looked around, found a trash bag, and plopped it unceremoniously on top of the mutilated creature and left it there. There was nothing I could do. I could not say anything. I could not comment. I could not impose my own values upon this situation. I shook Mom's hand and prepared to leave. I asked her if William could accompany me downstairs. I knew I would never see her again. So I followed him, and we stepped over the hallway mouse, and thankfully I remembered where the stairway mouse was located, and I descended into the darkness that had been so horrible before. I felt like I was escaping into the darkness, except this time I was escaping but reluctant to leave because I was leaving William there. In a situation that I could not control, I could have no impact upon, I couldn't even comment upon it. So I told him to please lock the door after I left. This obviously was not a good neighborhood, and I was concerned. And I turned one last time to my willing witness, and I shook his hand, and I thanked him for his memory, and I thanked him for his bravery. And I thanked him for his dedication to his mother. My stomach churned and my heart sank. I could do nothing more. You see, ethics preclude me from doing anything else. I cannot offer an incentive. I cannot offer a reward. I cannot give remuneration because anything like that would be considered bribery in a court of law. And then I would be compromising the situation for my client. And as much as I felt bad about it, there was nothing I could do. And so, having gotten what I needed, like a thief, a mere intruder, I left. I trudged across that icy street, opened my car door, and turned the heat up to maximum. And I turned on my beloved butt warmers. And I sat there waiting for the numbness to go away and for my body to feel again. I hadn't realized that I was crying until a tear dropped from my chin onto my bare hand. I felt so bad about not being able to do anything about the circumstances in that house, and for abandoning the inquisitive little boy with the big, beautiful eyes. Like the reporter in war-torn Somalia, I am only recording what I observe. I am not the UN aid worker who does something about it. My job requires that I often go against my more gracious instincts. The job had been done by the child, and I had done my job. He was a witness to a moment in time. I was just the investigator. So I released the emergency brake, and I left. Nothing had changed. I would do the same thing tomorrow, on a different case, in a different neighborhood, with a different witness.
Kitty Haley's job is to delve into people's lives and actions to understand and document crimes, large and small. She asks questions and compiles facts. Her notes and observations will then help attorneys build their cases. But that feeling of helplessness and hopelessness to change the world was so apparent. But what happens when you're looking at your own self and things are not quite what they seem? That's Carlos Rojas' story. We asked him about his woke moment. He described an experience where, after much convincing from friends and family, Carlos realizes that maybe it's he that has changed and not the world. Carlos Rojas' woke moment literally transcends reality.
This story has an ending, but multiple beginnings. It could have began 2 weeks before 2012 in Miami, New Year's Day, where I had the greatest idea in my entire life. It was this multimedia marriage of film and theater. It was about space colonization. And I would write this all down in my cat notebook, which I would then clutch tightly to my chest as I paced feverishly in my own bedroom for several hours. It could have began a little bit after that, where I was looking out the window to look at the peacocks, when all of a sudden, I could hear voices from miles away between neighbors in the community who were conspiring to steal all the strays in our neighborhood out of homophobic spite against me and my gay neighbor, Steve, because they knew how much we both loved cats. I was certain of it. It could have began a week before any of that happened, where I was coming on to an actor in a play that I was directing. I never would have imagined that he would be interested, and he seemed very uninterested and heterosexual, so much so that he mentioned his girlfriend 7 times. But apparently, no matter how many times he tried to share this information with me, I just wouldn't retain it. It could have began much later, where I was introducing my friends to weed for the first time. I felt very... It could have began after all of that, where I was introducing my friends to weed for the first time. I felt very cool. But then I began to fixate on this thought of, am I corrupting these people? I am totally corrupting these people. I am a horrible human being. And that night, I became so fixated on the thought that I could not sleep. That night, it was my mother who let me back in the house because I forgot my keys. And I smelt like blunt wraps. And she immediately knew what I had done. So she proceeded to hide in her bedroom to tell my stepdad that I smelled like marijuana. And I could tell that on the other line he just didn't care, so I just laid in the bed and pretended to sleep. I could not sleep, though. So then I just paced around the house until morning, where my mother would come out of her bedroom and start shifting furniture, moving objects, rearranging boxes. And I took one look at her and I thought, oh my God, she's a hoarder. How did I not realize this sooner? So I called our family friend Consuelo and told her that my mother was going mad and we needed her help. But then I realized that managing my mother's insanity was a 3-person job. So I called my stepdad as well. And by the time the 4 of us were in the same room, they were very confused because they kept looking at me and then at her. And they kept trying to explain to me that what was happening was normal. I tried really, really hard to explain why I did what I did, but I couldn't come up with anything. So I just took the easy way out and told them that I was very, very, very high. So I just laid on the couch while Consuelo told my mom that Una Chonga Sucia was the one who sold the drugs. And then I just felt really, really hungry, so I just went into the kitchen to boil some water to make some pasta, and she said, no, it's okay. Calm down. You don't need to do that. And then I just laid on the couch again and explained to my stepdad what pot was. That night, it seems like it was that night. It may not have been that night. It was New Year's Eve. My mother kept asking me all these questions like, are you okay? Why are you acting so strange? Are you going to kill yourself? And I told her, no, I'm the happiest I've ever been in my entire life. And that was the truth. She left to go celebrate, and I stayed home and played this song called Komm süßer Tod, which in German means come, sweet death. And in retrospect, it was actually very odd that I told my mother that I wasn't suicidal, because the image of me dancing in my own bedroom to Nihilist piano music was deeply troubling. Somewhere in this part of the story, I began to teleport to different parts of the house without realizing it. How did I end up in the living room? Why am I in the backyard? Why am I in front of the shrimp at the fridge? What's happening to my cat? Did I just molest my own cat? I now know for a fact that I did not molest my own cat, but the thought of it was so terrifying that it put me into a state of panic, and I actually did consider suicide because I was a dirty, cat-loving pervert who deserved to be put down. I was certain of it. I would then write a note to my mother and my stepdad condemning them for their bigotry, and I told them that there was a female spirit inside of me that could not be suppressed no matter how hard they tried. I don't really remember what happened to that note, but what I do remember was me throwing myself onto my mattress, writhing around in it for several hours before realizing, oh, I'm on PCP. That's what's happening. That night, the Yellow Jackets in my head were restless. And they were having this war against the Restoril armed forces. Every gunshot, every napalm blast, every grenade explosion was a suspicious thought fighting against my own logic. I would then call 911, hang up 2 seconds into the conversation, and then throw myself onto my mother's mattress, writhe around in it, and beg her to please take me to the psych ward.
After a terrible night, Carlos made up his mind to get help and checks into West Kendall Regional Medical Center in Miami.
At West Kendall Regional Medical Center, they asked me to describe what I was experiencing, and my answer was something like this. So basically, I'm here because I need a vacation, and I know that this isn't the place for a vacation, but I thought it would be really interesting for me to be here. I like your scrubs. Also, I really need something to drink, so if someone could bring me... Mom! Can you bring me something to drink? But it's okay if you don't want to go. Oh, you asked me a question. So basically, I'm here because I need a break, and I think coming here would really broaden my horizons, because, you know, I'm an artist, and it's the artist's job to torture themselves. Are you writing down everything I'm saying? She was. I was certain of it. She stopped to look at me and then continued to type. She looked young, perhaps only a few years older than me. I told her to take good care of me. A man in green scrubs stood in the corner, rolling his eyes at me. After they evaluated me, they made me pee into a container. My urine was dark brown. When was the last time you drank anything? I don't remember the last time I drank anything, but I think I ate some shrimp before I came here. Please help me. I think I'm going to die. Excuse me? She asked me to slow down 5 times. I couldn't stop. The Yellow Jackets were restless. They put me in a wheelchair and took me through several hallways. And in my field of vision, they looked cavernous, almost distorted. I looked up as they wheeled me through. The guy pushing me was really, really hot. They took me through this long, white, fluorescent hallway and just left me there. I looked to my left, and there was a glass screen that showed the rec room. A bland, white room with chairs and tables strewn about. The hardwood floors were light brown and could also be seen in the bedrooms. It was really eerie how much empty space there was in the bedrooms. You could easily get lost in the vastness of it all. I heard what Nurse Fuentes said. You think this is some kind of game? Nurse Fuentes was the man in green scrubs. Apparently, while I was in isolation, Nurse Fuentes told everybody that a special visitor was here to stay, and that this special visitor was an artist who was here to broaden his horizons. I could picture the air quotes and the vitriol in his speech. Suddenly, a few poorly chosen words made me the object of every nurse's hatred and the hospital's straw man. I spent 2 weeks at West Kendall Regional Medical Center. It was the worst 2 weeks of my entire life. All because Dr. Almunia did not know how to medicate me. Perhaps there was never really any formula for medicating the mentally ill. Perhaps it was all just guesswork. When we talk about psychotic episodes, and I feel like I've earned the right to use air quotes for that, it's not really a disorganized mess that happens up here. It's actually highly organized. It's a series of beginnings, where any of those moments could have been the start of it, a very confusing middle, where time folds in on itself, and a definite end, where one looks at their surroundings and asks, why am I in a psych ward right now? And that's what I call my psychotic episode.
Carlos Roa is working on a series of performances based on his recent experiences. One will be part of the Fringe Arts Festival. Elizabeth, maybe staying woke can go beyond being aware of injustice and racism.
I think so. I think being woke is essential for anything, in relationships, in the way you work, in the way you exist in the moment. I think every artist, in a way, knows what it means to be woke. You know it, you're a playwright. You have to be woke to the things that become the material for creativity.
Yes, and even being woke to how I myself am navigating through the world. That reminds me, Erykah Badu used the phrase stay woke in her song Master Teachers. It was from that album New America, Part 1, The Fourth World War. In the song, Badu wants to stay awake in order to find a beautiful world. Searching me, searching inside of you. A beautiful world. Yeah, I'd like to live in that place.
Check out Erykah Badu.
Stay woke. Even if your baby ain't got no money to support you, baby.
Now, I stay woke.
Even when the preacher tells you.
grudges and lies and cheating on your mama.
Stay woke.
Even though you go through struggle and strive to keep a healthy life.
Stay woke.
Everybody knows a black or white. There's creatures in every shape and size.
Stay woke.
To find out more about how to transform your life into a story, check out our podcast of conversations with the Woke Storytellers.
Yeah, I want to transform my life into a podcast.
You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Common Space includes a monthly broadcast and podcasts available on iTunes and Stitcher. Please subscribe, and while you're listening, give us a rating. I'm Jamie Brunson, host and co-writer of Common Space. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of Common Space and co-writer.
Our Common Space team members are producer Mike Villers, Dan Gosheski, Jen Cleary, and Ali L'Esperance. Our studio engineer is Diana Martinez. Our archivist is Neil Bartham. The theme music is by Subglow. And we'd like to give a special shout-out to director Danielle T. Marino and assistant director Steven Smith, who created the live first-person art show, Woke. And thank you for listening to Common Space.